This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
And breathe, everyone. That was a bit of an odd performance from Manchester City, but I guess it got the job done in the end. Three more points in the bag. The unbeaten home run has been preserved and safely into the international break, a point off the top of the table. The good news is we all expect City to get better. The bad news is that they clearly have some issues to work out in how they'll do it. We'll review the win over Fulham on today's Blue Moon podcast, and we'll also discuss the other big story of the week. City have claimed victory in their case against the Premier League's Associated Party Transactions rules, while the Premier League have also claimed a victory. We'll get to the bottom of it all with the football finance expert Kieran Maguire. And we've also got the former City goalkeeper David Seaman on the show. He's going to tell us all about his few months at Eastlands after a distinguished career at Arsenal and what it was like joining Kevin Keegan's team at that time. I'm David Mooney, and with me for this week's show, I've got City fan Paul Atherton.
In the mids.
And from statcity.co.uk, Adam Carter.
Hello.
Hello, hello. I mean, the thing to address first, Adam, I speak to you all the time. Paul, it's been how long since you've been on?
I don't know. I bet you know the answer, don't you? A couple of years, maybe.
Adam probably knows the answer. He's the spreadsheet guy. Yeah.
I don't think anyone's interested in those stats.
Well, I know, but you say that. The number of people who have said to me, "Have you and Paul fallen out? I've never heard him on anymore." I was like, "No, we still play football together, but you know, he's just a busy guy these days."
We do fall out in the football world, don't we? Anyway.
Yeah, we try not to, but we do. Adam, you well? You good?
Yep, all good. I'm legalised up to the max, ready to go.
Excellent, excellent. The best way to be, I find. Well, before we get into all of that, since we're going to be hearing from David Seaman a bit later on, and he joined City at the grand old age of 39, I thought I'd ask you two about your favourite veteran players that have joined the club. Who stands out from those players that have joined in, like, the twilight of their career, the sun's going down on their career after perhaps better spells elsewhere, coming to City for one last hurrah. Paul, who are you having for this? Who stands out as a veteran for you?
I remember, obviously, part of growing up, Ali Benabia. Just veteran midfielder, great on the ball, great to watch. It was just like a different class of footballer in our team at the time. So he sticks out for me.
Yeah, he was one of those players that I don't know if he kind of fits the bill in the sense of kind of had distinguished career elsewhere, though, because he certainly came to City as a bit of an unknown, and then when he got to City, we're all like, oh fucking hell, this guy's quite good.
Yeah, I don't understand how he didn't do better than he did, because his class was just unbelievable. Just unlike, you know, I think was it him who had the story about where he signed another deal and then walked in and said, actually, I can't do it, and walk out because he was kind of furious himself that he dropped down a level or something. He couldn't perform at the level I think City required at that time. Don't know if that rings a bell.
It might be him. I mean, he ended up in Qatar after City. So, I mean, who goes to Qatar? That's the thing. Adam, who are you having for this?
You'll kick off, but I'm going for Robbie Fowler.
You know I'm going to kick off because... Yeah, but he was 28 when he joined City.
Yeah, I know, but I'm going for twilight of his performing power and not necessarily twilight of his aging career. So I just couldn't believe we'd sign someone of his calibre. Yes, he was awful, but I'm here for it. I'm standing by it.
All the names you could have had, and you've picked it. Like, he was 28. You could have, like, listen to the list of players that City have had at that age. You could have someone like Patrick Vieira, who was like an absolute class act. You could have the greatest footballer of all time, George Weah. But no, you didn't think of any of them. You've gone for a 28-year-old.
Yeah, and he actually went to Liverpool after us as well, didn't he? So he's not... I'm just... As soon as you said twilight of career, I think... We obviously got him at the tail end, or certainly tailing off, and I just couldn't believe it. So that's why when you asked me about a twilight player, he was the first one that came. I didn't realise he was 28 until you've told me. But I've said it, it's out there, it's on record, so I've got to stand by it.
Yeah, a whole, 5 years younger than Ali Benabia? I'm not, no, sorry. Right, yes. So veteran players coming up later on. Let's start with, normally we'd do the game review here, but with it being the international week, I think the news agenda has kind of taken over, because Steve on the emails has been in touch to say, I sat through the Premier League's lawyer-esque gobbledygook explanation of why they won this battle, by the end of which the reporter might just have well been talking Mandarin for all the sense it made to me. Then another journalist was brought in to simplify the written text on our screens. My reaction, exactly the same. This, of course, had nothing to do with the 115, but I wonder, does any of it bode well or badly for us in this far bigger case? Well, the good news for Steve is that I've been speaking to the football finance expert, Kieran Maguire, from the Price of Football podcast to try and put all of what's happened this week into plain English.
What's happened is that City decided they didn't like the direction of travel in respect of what the Premier League was trying to do to restrict the ability of clubs to have relationships with sponsors. They decided to effectively say this was not competitive. It would appear from reading the documents that the Commission has some sympathy with City's position. I think that the big issue, as far as City are concerned, is that in its present form, it's unfair, it's inconsistent to say to a club owner, you cannot put money into a club via a sponsor, or we're going to restrict your ability to put money into a club via a sponsor. But you can effectively financially benefit a club by giving it interest-free loans. Because if I went to a commercial bank, if we take the case of Arsenal, because I appreciate that, you know, Arsenal and City aren't the best of pals at present, Arsenal's owners have put in 250 million quid. If we charge a commercial rate of, say, 8%, that would mean that Arsenal will be paying £20 million a year in interest over the three-year PSR period. That's 60 million quid. That's okay. And when the Premier League clubs voted on this, as they did a few years ago, 19-1 in favour, said, yeah, interest-free loans, fill your boots, happy days. Well, what's the difference between that and perhaps City having a sponsor who is from Abu Dhabi, who is putting in a reasonably generous, but not obscenely generous, sponsorship deal, which itself is worth 20 million quid. So can you see it from City's point of view? So I think that's one of the things. The other thing which seems to have come across is, under the proposed APT rules, it's up to the club to prove that if the Premier League's Fair Market Commission, if they think City's sponsorship is too high, it's up to the club to try to prove that it's not too high. So that's effectively, you're guilty until proven innocent. And City is saying, well, hold on, that goes against surely all of sort of historic law, which has always been innocent until proven guilty. So those are the two major issues as far as the club is concerned. The Premier League is saying, well, that's not much to worry about. But, you know, City's view is, in its present form, that the rules cannot be applied. And they feel discriminated against because the rules were introduced in a rush, effectively immediately after the Newcastle takeover by PIF. And given that City's owners come from the same region, they feel that there's an element of targeting clubs that are owned by Middle Eastern countries, or, you know, of ownership linked to Middle Eastern countries.
Yeah. Oh, when you look at kind of the judgment that was made, I mean, ultimately, City will point to the judgment saying that the rules were unlawful. The Premier League at the same time has pointed to the fact that the panel found that there is an element of kind of restriction that needs to be made in order to have a competitive balance. Both sides are claiming a win in this. How do you see it? Is it effectively both sides have things that they can take from the judgment?
Yes. I personally, I'm staggered that the Premier League claiming that the rules are there for competitive balance. Because if you take a look at UEFA's cost control rules, they say specifically it's not there to create a level playing field. That's what I'd understand by competitive balance. So where the Premier League has got this idea from my point of view, is fanciful. But they are saying that some form of cost control rules make some form of sense. I think most football fans would broadly agree. If Manchester City had the same owners and they hadn't won the Premier League, for the last four seasons, I suspect these particular sets of rules perhaps wouldn't have been introduced. To me, as an outsider, and I'm a Brighton fan, so I've not got dog in the fight. You know, Brighton are never going to win the Premier League, so it doesn't bother me one way or the other. It does seem that there are other clubs who don't like the idea of Manchester City being successful. And yet when we've had dynasties before, and I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough to remember when Liverpool used to regularly win the old First Division, the equivalent of the Premier League. And then when the Premier League was formed, I think another club won it quite often. I can't remember who they are. I can't remember where they come from. And nobody said, well, actually, if you take a look, those clubs have financial advantages. Yeah, those clubs have financial benefits from bigger stadiums, from better commercial deals. And football's a talent game. The talent follows where the money's available. Nobody's got an issue in terms of that, I don't think. Yeah, why people moan about players' wages. If you were a talented footballer, if I was a talented footballer, I'd say, well, I'm part of the entertainment industry. Roger Federer, Tiger Woods, they all earn a fortune from their sports for being the best. Why the difference in football? So, yeah, it does seem that this issue of competitive balance, the commission has agreed with that. But the commission also agreed that despite a letter coming from a Premier League club, which was apparently supported by 10 other Premier League clubs, and the letter was sent almost straight after the acquisition of Newcastle by PIF, and the letter made reference to Gulf States, apparently that's not discriminating against Gulf States, because the Premier League said, well, could have said American clubs, but it didn't say American clubs, it specifically said Gulf States. So the victories that the Premier League is claiming, and I think this is where everybody has become obsessed, because they're looking for a winner in respect of this. I don't think there is a winner. The more you read it, it's a broad conclusion. The APT rules are illegal, so I think City can take some solace from that. They're being inconsistently applied. I think City can also draw a degree of solace from the commission saying that the Premier League was taking far too long to reach a conclusion as to whether some of City's commercial deals could be signed off, given that if we go to the other set of legal issues in relation to the Premier League and Manchester City, the Premier League have said that Manchester City haven't cooperated. Well, it looks like the Premier League have not cooperated when it comes to the speedy resolution to whether or not a deal can be signed off by the relevant parties.
Yeah. When it comes to, because the other part of this, you mentioned it before about the shareholder or director loans. Could clubs just solve it by giving equity to the people who have those loans?
They could, but when you start to look at the numbers, Premier League football clubs presently have somewhere in the region of £1.9 billion worth of loans from owners. Now, it could be that the owner is saying, well, actually, at some point in the future, I want some of that money back. You know, I support Brighton, and last year they repaid the owner £30 million back. It could be that he says, well, yeah, I've lent you over £400 million. I want to get it down to £200 million, but then perhaps I'm willing to convert £200 into equity. So it's not as simple as just converting loans into shares, because if you've got a single owner, it's less of an issue. But if you've got multiple owners, we've got complications. Let's take the case of Crystal Palace. They've got John Textor, Steve Parrish. They've got the two other American owners, I think Harris and Blitzer. And between them, they own 100% of Crystal Palace. Well, not all of them have lent money interest-free to Palace, but some of them have. So at present, John Textor has got 45% of Crystal Palace. But let's say that he's got loans, which if he converts into shares, he ends up with more than 50% of Crystal Palace. All of a sudden, can you see the dynamics in terms of who controls Crystal Palace completely change? You can understand the other shareholders saying, well, hold on, we don't want John Textor to end up as the majority owner of Crystal Palace. And that could also apply to other clubs as well. So it will change and it will dilute some shareholdings for existing shareholders, which they might not be happy about. It could completely change the dynamics as to who controls an individual club. And that's been conveniently ignored by the people who are saying, yeah, but you just convert your loans into shares And then the problem goes away because there are no interest-free loans. So Manchester City haven't got anything to argue about.
Yeah, does if that were if they were to change the regulations on that aspect of the APT rules, would it would need a Premier League vote, wouldn't it? So again, is this the sort of the essence of Turkey's voting for Christmas? Is there a sense of well, the clubs aren't going to vote for something that will then hamstring them as well?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. There's two issues. When this was voted on the last time, they voted 19-1 in favour of allowing interest-free loans to be treated as interest-free loans for the purposes of PSR. So that's going to have to be a very, very significant U-turn in terms of the wishes of club owners. Now, I think Stefan Borsten, I think he's picked up something from UEFA's rule. I think UEFA do appear to charge an interest rate, although it would be interesting to know what it was. But it is a significant issue. But I think there's another angle which people are completely disregarding. What happens if I'm somebody who is thinking of buying into a Premier League football club and I was thinking of providing it with funding in the form of interest-free loans? All of a sudden, that football club becomes less attractive to investors. That has an implication for the valuation of all Premier League football clubs. And it could mean that some potential deals, and get some owners are more popular than others, and that's not just in the Premier League, but in the Championship as well. You might have somebody who's buying into a Championship football club who thinks, well, if things work out, I'll put through some interest-free loans. That's going to assist this club in getting promoted to the Premier League. All of a sudden, whoever gets to the Premier League, I'm going to have to write off those loans. Don't fancy doing that. Tell you what, I'll go and invest in basketball, or I'll go and invest in horse racing, or I'll go and invest in Formula One instead.
Yeah. The other aspect that I'm interested in is obviously these are associated party transactions. How close does an association have to be? Because I mean, I think about it as like if it's a related party, for instance, then you're looking at you've got an almost definite kind of argument of who owns what and who's invested in which company and where. But for instance, like you said before, you like me and you have an association in that we are now appearing on a podcast together, but we don't know each other and we don't know each other very well. And it just kind of strikes me that it's almost a very arbitrary measure of kind of what an association could be.
Yes. I mean, under the accounting rules, both sort of the domestic rules for accounting that we have here in the UK and under the international rules, we have something called a related party. And that's a very definitive and quite narrow definition of somebody connected to a party. You either own the club by having more than 50% of the shares. You can influence the club. They normally say the threshold there is 20%, or you could be a close family member to a director, or you are a director. So yeah, the rules are there are relatively narrow, but very, very clear. In terms of associated parties, it broadly seems to say that anybody does a deal of more than £1 million, then we have to investigate. And things start to get messy, and you end up checking people's WhatsApp. Oh, two people have had a WhatsApp conversation. Are they associated parties? Are they not? And I don't like to get into the court of whataboutery, but you look at some of the relationships between some club owners who have got business interests in some countries, which might then be involved in the acquisition of a club, and you go, well, are we sort of, you know, you scratch my nose, I'll scratch yours in terms of we'll sign off a separate contract for a separate industry on the basis of this. It is very messy and it's creating huge layers of bureaucracy because the Premier League's excuse for not getting the deals through signed in respect of City is, oh, we've not got enough staff. So what they're saying is we need to employ more people. So you want to employ more bureaucrats. The average cost of employing somebody at the Premier League is £141,000. So you're increasing your costs for contracts where they're trying to find relationships between people, which may or may not exist. It's just incredibly messy. It's not the reason why you fell in love with David football, and it's not the reason why I fell in love with football. Is it a byproduct of the fact that we've got probably three more zeros in football than we had 20 or 30 years ago? Yeah, it is. You know, as soon as something starts to become successful, you've got people involved from satellite industries who will benefit and who will try to say that this is right and this is wrong and so on.
Yeah. Final question then, Kieran, because, and I appreciate that you don't have a crystal ball, but how do you see this going now? What do you see the future being around this? Because obviously the City are facing the case with the 115 charges. This, I suspect, won't have a massive impact on that one way or the other. But it feels like this is a massive mess for everybody to get out of now.
Yeah, it's also a very expensive mess. The fact that City's legal counsel has written to the other 19 clubs to say that the Premier League's interpretation of the verdict, because if you take a look at the summary of the verdict, does appear to indicate that Manchester City have been pretty successful. So it does appear to be very messy. I read an article in the Times today that both the Premier League and the City are going to try to get the commission to give a more definitive answer, because the more you read it, the less clear it appears to become. The present rules don't appear to be fit for purpose. Is that a surprise? It's not. If you introduce a set of rules 3 or 4 weeks after a takeover, from an outsider's perspective appears to be linked to a takeover, then those rules will not have been stress tested. They won't have been through sort of the normal rigor that you would expect to happen under some form of regulation. I think it strengthens the hand for those people that want an independent regulator. And my view is, on the balance of probabilities, the pluses of the regulator outweigh the minuses. But I still think it's an absolute indication of a dereliction of duty from, first of all, the Football Association, and secondly, the Premier League, in terms of its inability to govern itself, that we've ever reached this position of having legislation having to go through Parliament.
Yeah. Just on the 115 charges as well, is there any likelihood to be any implications for that?
No, because I think if we take a look at the 115 charges, they are specifically covering the period 2009 to 2018, whereas the Associated Party Transactions rule is effectively a set of guidelines going forward. So they weren't introduced until 2021. And then we've got a new set of APT rules, which appear to have been helicoptered in by the Premier League in 2024. So they are very much independent of one another. Again, if you're looking at it from an outsider's point of view, the fact that Manchester City's legal team appear to have found some pretty awkward issues for the Premier League and some pretty big holes in the Premier League handbook might lead you to conclude that there could be other holes in the Premier League handbook which have been equally of interest to the KCs and the barristers involved in respect of City's defence against the Premier League's charges.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
So that was Kieran Maguire talking about the Associated Party transactions case with me. Adam, I mean, let's start with, because I don't expect you two to kind of have a lot of input with this, because it's a legal thing that, I mean, the your common fan doesn't really have a lot of understanding of. But like, with that in mind, how's it making you all feel? Do you care? Is it an annoying sideshow? Are you following it? Are you ignoring it? What's happening?
So I try and ignore it. I'm so bored of it, but I'm going to really try and play up my position here, which is not at all. But because I've got a bit of a profile on Twitter, I'm a bit of a lightning rod for rival fans. So as soon as any news comes out, my feed is just full of people from rival fan bases just tagging me and all these types of things. So I feel like I've got to stay across it for that. But as a match-going fan, I'm absolutely bored. I mean, my spreadsheets detail how many times we've scored from a corner, not how many zeros we've got on our balance sheet. So
I was going to say, when you've got somebody who works with spreadsheets saying that they're bored, I mean, goodness me.
I'm having that as my profile bio. That is fantastic.
The depths that we've had to dig to get somebody who does boring things for a living, like, to actually go, you know what, I've had enough of this.
I love that, yeah. My data analysis day job is astounding compared to these APT charges or rules and regulations. I'm just sick of it. I feel like, as City fans, we've got to have some almost something in our armoury to defend against the attacks, whether it's down the pub, whether I know, because there's that weird meme where you go, oh, I was just talking to the lads in the pub about this, when you see some legal spiel on Twitter. But it is actually, you know,
it's coming
it is
true,
seeping
yeah.
in. It's seeping into those type of conversations. It's in the work break room. It's in the pub. It's on the terrace, and it's just like, why can we not just go and watch a football and don't care, a football match, and don't care how those 11 players got assembled to be on that pitch at that time, whether it was legal or not? I didn't care when Chelsea's money came in. I didn't care when United was spending all their money, because I was just focused on City and how we did. And nothing's changed apart from the fact that we almost need to be arming ourselves with this knowledge, even though I couldn't. None of us have got a legal degree in that field, so we'd be in the courtroom if we did, wouldn't we? And not on Twitter message boards.
Yeah. If I had any understanding of the case, I wouldn't be sat here doing a podcast about it. But there we are. Paul, we were chatting on Tuesday, as the listeners, as I told the listeners earlier, we do play football together. We were chatting after the game. You're not a lawyer, but your day job, you're an accountant. So you've got a little bit of more of an understanding of the finance side of things at the very least than I do. Just explain what you said to me on Tuesday about APT compared to director loans and shareholder loans.
Yeah, this is the caveat that obviously Kieran's the expert, and everything he said was, you know, made a lot of sense. I think what I did like is the fact that obviously City, everyone thought this was a bit of a deflection, but actually it was making quite clear points about the inconsistencies of the rules and what it was targeted. So when you're going back to the point, is obviously you know, a lot of the issues around like equity funding and obviously it being unfair if you've got like no untapped resources that you can just pull on any time. Whereas going back to the point here, is I think City's really strong point that they made was around, you know, equity funding being bad and if you use associated party transactions, that's bad. But what City made a really good point was around shareholder loans and like related party debt from you know, shareholders ultimately. So it's hard to do this without naming any names, but I'm sure you could read between the lines. You know, if they do have interest-free loans, they are akin to equity and tax rules. I work in tax, and there's thin capitalization rules that look at like arm's length transactions, and you have to hypothesize, would the man on the street or the bank be willing to lend that on third party arm's length terms? And you know, would a bank lend hundreds of millions interest-free? No, it wouldn't. Therefore, tax rules say it's akin to equity and you can't have a tax deduction for it. And then I think that's City's point in a completely different area, is like, you know, you can't really pick on City for this if you're not going to pick on interest-free loans from shareholders. So that was, you know, without reading it or in much detail, that was the post-football chat that we had.
Yeah, it's exciting, things we say after the game, isn't it? That's it. I'm interested as well, Paul, just on I tried to get into it a bit with Kieran there. In tax purposes, is there much of a difference between a related party and an associated party?
Well, it depends what tax legislation and what area. Like, yes. So yeah, I don't want to get into that. Yeah, it depends if it's income tax, corporate tax.
Right, I see.
But overall, like, there's different, like, you know, so related can be, if it's like a corporate group, associated tends to look beyond a corporate group and like, you know, individual persons that have common interests in things. So,
yeah. So basically what I'm getting at is in this case, you reckon, if you look at the Premier League, the way the Premier League rules are written, I guess associated could just be anyone with any sort of association that they want to have an association. The burden of proof mustn't be that high to say, well, you are associated.
Yeah, I think what City is saying is, you, like, if you're going to do this and draft it and have a legal definition, you should follow substance based, because that's what tax does. It's like, you know, if you're going to look at this, look at the overall substance and then get your legislation right and make it work. And I think that's the whole point, that at the moment it's trying to beat up, you know, Newcastle really when it first happened. So, but they're not beating up the other situations, which, you know, those loans are akin to equity anyway, because they're not going to be repaid in reality.
Yeah.
Be repaid on an exit or a sale, probably.
Yeah. So we wait. I was going to say with interest, but it's not really with interest. It's just, you know, we wait for whatever will happen next. Let's talk about why people are actually here and get to the football. Because, Adam, in the introduction, I called the performance against Fulham odd. Have you worked out if City were good or not in that game yet?
I'm still trying to work out why we conceded the first goal in every game at the Etihad this season, which was utterly bizarre. So we'll park that for a second. But in periods, we were great. can I do a bit of both in?
I mean, the answer is a bit of both. That's entirely the point of that question, but yeah.
They looked dangerous on the attack. I think we looked a bit fragmented in defence. It was a bit all over the place. We usually have a better shape at the back, and I was hoping that without Rodri, our kind of a stable back line would be what we would need to kind of not be so susceptible to those kind of transitions. That didn't seem to be the case, certainly in the first half, a bit in the second half as well, to be honest. So I was hoping life after Rodri was looking, we might just get more players being stable and not just relying on him to kind of be the stabilising, you know, pivot on his own in that middle of the park. So we didn't get that. We conceded the first goal like we did against Brentford and Ipswich and Watford before it was ruled out, and then Fulham. So there is a theme there that I'm concerned about.
But it's not just Rodri, though, is it? Because the number of times where there was, I mean, I'm just going to say there was an alarming amount of space in City's box where the ball just came in and it either missed a Fulham player or, like, I mean, the goal at the end, Muniz had what? He had run of the penalty area.
Well, yeah, he took it down and then swiveled on it. And also their first goal, you're able to backheel a pass across your six-yard box. Well, even though it's looped over a Kanji, I tweeted as soon as it went. I was like, the opposition cannot be passing to each other in your six-yard box. That's just unacceptable at any level, let alone when you're going for a Premier League title. So there was gaping holes everywhere. Yeah, it wasn't just in the middle of the park. But I just think it's easy to see. I'm focusing on the absence of Rodri, and that's why I'm kind of blinded by anything else that goes thereafter, because as soon as you take Rodri out of that team, I'm allowing anything because he's that important to us. And I think I would have liked other people to step up, and like you say, you'd want them to step up all over the park, and that hasn't been the case. It's hardly panic stations, but it's just areas for concern, I'll label that one as.
Yeah. Paul, what do you make of Rodri's kind of absence and what City can do with the transitions? Because City traditionally don't like teams that counter as quickly and as effectively as Fulham did. And Rodri is quite often the answer to that. So without him there, and having seen a few games recently where he hasn't been there, what's your feeling for the solution? Gundogan, Kovacic? I mean, Kovacic did well, he scored twice, but there were still moments.
I wish I did know the solution. I'm not sure. I think
well, like with the APT stuff, if you knew it, you wouldn't be here, would you?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's control, isn't it, really? Like, I feel like a lot of the vulnerable part of the way we're playing this season is the fact that they're in our half because we're not controlling the ball. We're giving it away too simply. And that's the main issue. Like, had teams got in our half in more in previous seasons, we probably would have looked shambles in the way we have anyway. So I think it's that. And then maybe that's part not pressing high enough, not winning the ball, but not having Rodri as the out ball coming backwards to then distribute it wide and do that. And just the absolute control he has personally the game in that fixed point. That means that the, you know, Bernardo and Gundogan could be a bit freer around him. I think that's the main. I don't think it's necessarily Rodri on the defence. I think it's Rodri in control of the ball.
Yeah. I mean, control of the team.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can't have many more midfielders that control the ball than Grealish, Gundogan, and Kovacic, like in world football. So, you know, maybe it is the pressing at the top with them.
Is it a physicality thing, maybe? Because you look at Lewis stepping into the middle, and like as good as Lewis has been, he can get knocked around a bit.
It could be, but I mean, he brings many other, you know, he's more dynamic and can catch back, catch them up as well, and he probably wins the ball more. So I don't think you could just look at that necessarily. And he would have had that probably in his whole career as well, wouldn't he? So, yeah, it's difficult to say, really.
Adam, I mentioned Lewis. Obviously, there was the chances with Traore getting through. One of them was a Lewis misstep. I actually wondered if Lewis could have stretched a toe out and got to the ball before Traore did, but he didn't. Edison saved it. Doesn't matter. It was an interesting selection from Guardiola to go, listen, I expect them to use Traore on the break. Yeah. We're gonna kind of just deal with it as it comes.
Yeah. So. Pep's always publicly petrified of Traore in previous games, whether he was at Wolves. He obviously knows him from the Barcelona setup as well. So he's publicly, it's well known that he has these players that give him sleepless nights, and obviously Traore is one of them. So I was equally surprised to see Lewis was starting. I was fine with it as well, though. Like you say there, he's obviously gone, well, we know about that threat. It's a well-known threat, but I'd rather have what Lewis gives us, stepping into midfield and hopefully controlling the game that way. He had all his controllers on for the start of that match. Then, obviously, the chance you alluded to there where Lewis got beaten to it, or kind of a misstep, as you say, I thought, oh, hang about, this is definitely a mismatch. Then he brought Walker on in the second half to counter that. So I thought, you know, okay, it's the right thing. He's kept Lewis on, but he's also brought Walker on to deal with that threat. And I've been defending Walker recently to the guy next to me who hates him. But I've been saying, don't worry, Walker's got his pace. He'll get us out of it. And then when he got beaten by Traore, how do I defend Walker now? Because that was the only thing he was in the team for. He came on to do that job and didn't do that job. So between Lewis and Walker, we didn't have an answer for Traore. And he had the run of the Etihad that afternoon. Luckily, he'd left his shooting boots at home. But with the Walker decision, it probably proved Pep right, really, because he didn't do the job that I thought he was coming on to do when he came on. So.
Yeah, here's a stat for you, Paul. City's XG for the entire game. I don't know where you stand on XG. I don't know if me and you have had this. I've had the good old chat about XG. I like it as a measure, but City's XG for the game 1.57. Adama Traore's XG for the game 1.29. Fulham had the better XG overall. The vast majority of it was Adama Traore's, and he was almost as threatening as City on his own. He was almost as threatening as City as a team. Does he just frighten the pants off you as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still scarred by the Wolves game where
who isn't
the
<yeah.
laughs> Otamendi. Oh my word! That before did he nutmegged him about two times, and you're like, at this level, like, don't dive in. Yeah, Otamendi's just dived in. Right, great. Okay, there's another goal. I do, because the stuff he does, like holding it up and be direct, you think if it's kind of like playground stuff and you think that can't work at this level, but he's just absolutely bullying everyone. I mean, when does Kyle Walker get bullied for pace and strength? Like, it doesn't, well, maybe a bit more so the last year and a half, but overall it doesn't happen. So it just shows how good he is. So yeah, he's just a, yeah, I don't know how you really deal with him. You'd probably put a Kanji on him, maybe.
Well, it doesn't really matter. You kind of have to let him run through and then miss, don't you? Because you look at what Edison did in that game. Have you thought Edison's needed a display like that, Paul? Just on the basis of he always gets criticised for not making saves. And then here we are, two massive one-on-ones.
Yeah, I mean, but Champions League final as well. He's like arguably one of our top two players in that game. Yeah, I mean, the issue is he's kind of being tested a little bit more now that teams are in our half a bit more. But I mean, like, it's good to have those games in the season. I remember I said it about Joe Hart a few years ago. Well, about 10 years ago now, is it? 12 years ago.
Back in the old days.
It was when you were last on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. When you say, like, you know, there should be two or three games a season when a keeper, like, wins you the game. I'm still waiting for you to do it on a Tuesday, Moons.
Oh, but, I saw that coming a mile off.
Yeah. But, he is a great shot stopper. I think with Edison, it's more like the sort of stupid things, like when he kicked the – well, I can't remember the game now. When he kicked the player in the middle of the penalty area, it's clearly the –
You're thinking of Anfield last season, aren't you?
Yeah, that sort of stuff. But I think the fact that he does that, he doesn't seem to have the switch where he, like, oh, I've made a mistake there. He seems to be over it straight away, and that's why he's so good. It's like kind of what Schmeichel used to be like, I guess. You know, he wouldn't own up to it, and he'd move on, and then he'd you know, he's not affected confidence-wise by things that he does.
Yeah, I think he did need a display like this, certainly after Ortega's heroics in the Spurs game at the end of last season to prove, like, look, I can do it too. I think Pep's recently mentioned how instrumental and integral he is to our title-winning sides over the years as well. So it would have been sad to see him go. Annoyingly, we have got the Ortega save in our recent memory to go off, and they were two, obviously the one-on-one from Son to almost win us the league in that little moment, in that individual moment.
Just I'm going to interrupt you there, Adam. Just rank all three one-on-one saves, best to worst for me, please.
Well, exactly the exact same save three times.
Come on, tell me, which one was the best of the three of them?
The Son one.
Oh, so Edison's not going to like that, is he? That's the thing.
No, that's what. But what I'm saying is, I'm not downplaying Edison's achievements because I think he's more integral to the wider picture of City and how we play. But in that moment, we're talking about Ederson's performance against Fulham. Ortega has that in the bank in recent memory. So knowing what you've got till it's gone, it's when Ortega tries to do a pass across his own six-yard box and fails, that's when we'll be saying, I wish Ederson was in there.
Yeah.
So it's the wider picture that he brings. And I'm glad he stayed. Look, I never wanted him to go. I was just not particularly worried if he did, because Ortega's proven himself better than all of our recent memory subkeepers. So, but yeah, you'd much rather him be at your club than anywhere else, I would say.
Yeah, no, I understand that entirely. Just before we move on from the keepers, Paul, I just want to read something. It's a text you sent me earlier this year. If it helps, it was a sensational save. That was when I put my shoulder out saving a one-on-one for you. There you go.
I remember this.
I was talking about Ederson's save. You don't need our compliments, because you'll put it on Twitter yourself, won't you?
Yeah.
Or X or whatever. Yeah, social media. Yeah,
of course I will.
These days.
Yeah. We got David Seaman coming up later on, and you told me once that one of my saves was like one of his. So that'll probably come up again later on in the show as well.
At what stage of his career?
FA Cup final, Sheffield United, when he scooped it out, that one.
Oh yeah, Old Trafford.
Yeah, yeah, same profile, same pressure game as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't already we weren't already losing 7-0 at that point.
Yeah. Adam, just before we finish on the Fulham game, I've seen a lot of discontent recently about Guardiola's, let's call them cautious selections. It seems to centre around Bernardo and Grealish on either side of Haaland, which I find mad that people are calling that cautious, given Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, those games were had that front three. This is the front three that won the treble. It's like the idea that it's not creative. I don't know where that's come from.
Yeah, and Bernardo created the most chances in the first half as well, I read. So it's perception. The guy next to me at the Etihad, he almost collapses every time we get the ball and we've got a chance to break and we come backwards and get back in shape and play it sideways. And I have to tell him every time, this is by design. Like, he's one. I'm like, it's all part of the process, and the process has got us four titles in a row and we're going for five. Like, he's been there all those seasons. He's enjoyed all those trophy lifts. Yet we seem to forget. He seems to forget that each week we're not just going to revert to type. In fact, I think Pep's getting more cautious because he wants more of a stronger hold on things, because he knows how much is at stake and how little time he's got, potentially got left at the club. Mm-hmm. His legacy. He's not going to want to just go gung ho all of a sudden. But we're spoiled with Bernardo and Grealish on the flank. So I think we should try and enjoy it and trust the process. I know that's a very current phrase being borrowed by our neighbours across the way there, trust the process. But I think in our case, we've got proof in the pudding to trust that process. But yeah, I understand it's perception rather than reality, though, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
We've been here before. If you replay any season review, there'll have been this discontent, there'll be these disgruntled conversations on the terraces, but 9 times out of 10, we're at the other end of the season and we're lifting another pot, and I'll patiently wait for that again, please.
Yeah. Paul, as I've seen you enough times on a football pitch know like when to slow a game down. And it's not just like we're getting older now, so we have to slow it down a bit. But you there is an understanding of that sometimes the right thing to do for the game is to not stretch this and not make it really open. And you watch the way that Guardiola's teams have played in the last, certainly the last kind of in the four in a row that City have done. They are very much centered on knowing when the right time to attack is and not leaving yourself vulnerable by trying to take a advantage of an open game. And you look at that when you see that he hasn't got Rodri in the middle, it makes sense that he would pick Bernardo and Grealish on the wings instead of Doku and Savinho at the moment, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because I think he's saying these players are more than good enough anyway. So if we control it, I trust them to figure it out.
Yeah.
That's ultimately what he's doing. And that is what the players do. They kind of go, well, I'm not used to this. I need to work out where the space is, work out how much time I'm going to get on the ball. I don't know if the defender's going to be in my face or like straight away. So I think that's why he's picking those players, and I completely get it. He always does this when he's like, you know, ramping up to sort of like, you know, end of season, when we can all pick his first 11, can't we? Like, I remember the Champions League final two, 3 years ago when we could pick the team. And it's the same now. I've got no idea what the team's going to be because I think he just wants to get control and get some consistency and have some confidence because at the moment, I don't think it's quite there.
Yeah. And that's not to say as well that Doku and Savinho aren't possibles for starting places and that they won't have an impact coming off the bench. It's just that at the moment, while he's working some stuff out, he goes back to what he knows.
Yeah. I feel like this is we've seen this more this season than any season other than his first. And I think part of that is injuries, departures, and then, you know, lack of signings really other than Savinho. And like obviously they got one eye on the court case and they don't know what's going to happen. So that's probably part of why that's the case.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Let's go back to what feels like a much simpler time. In 2003, City were moving into the newly built City of Manchester Stadium. They'd just finished ninth in the Premier League in their final season at Main Road, and they were looking to build on that under Kevin Keegan. They needed a new number one, though. Peter Schmeichel had retired at the end of the previous campaign, and Keegan didn't have a huge budget, so he settled on another veteran, the former Arsenal keeper David Seaman. He spent around half a season at City, and I've been speaking to him about that period. We started with how he ended up in Manchester.
So I played my last game for Arsenal. Was the FA Cup final against Southampton, and I didn't know it was my last game. So, because at the time I was on like a 1 year contract, so and it was good for me because I didn't know whether I wanted to retire or whatever because I was 39 at the time. And so I played that game. I was captain. I'd lifted the trophy, and then I was on holiday in Portugal. Arsene phoned me up, so I've got an offer for you. I was like, okay. And his first offer was like, I want you to be my number three goalkeeper, and I was like, whoa. He said, but I want you to be my goalkeeping coach. And it was something that I was quite interested in at the time. And then he went, there's a 75% wage drop. You know, so from that, you know, obviously the wage drop side of it was a big influence. But the fact that he wanted me to be a number three was like a signal to me thinking, because I always thought and I always wanted to play another year at least. And then Man City came in for me and actually Birmingham came in for me as well because I'd chatted to Steve Bruce. And the fact I didn't want to go back to a club that I'd already been at. So then when CT came in for me and it was Kevin, I spoke to Kevin and then once you speak to Kevin, you're signing. because his enthusiasm is brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to ask about him because there's a lot of that era of City that he's built on basically Kevin Keegan vibes.
Yeah.
And you'd worked with him with England and stuff like that briefly. So yeah. Like what was it about City that was the draw?
One of them was the new stadium. You know, the City of Manchester Stadium, I think it was called. Was that and then just the fact of coming up to Manchester. And being back up north, as I call it. But, yeah, it was just that appeal of going into the new stadium, being, you know, like you could tell that it was going to be getting bigger and bigger. Obviously, you couldn't tell how big it's to what it's become. But the draw was just to be, I suppose, on the blue side of Manchester as well, you know, after having, you know, some mixed results against the red side.
Do you think about that in terms of moving clubs?
Little bits, but... You know, it was just that, you know, like I just fancied Man City. You know, I just liked that appeal. Obviously, Peter had been before me, you know, and I just wanted to, yeah, just to see what it was like, you know, because I knew that, you know, the passion of the Man City fans for me is more, or how can I put, not more natural, but so when I moved into Manchester, all the white van men and all, you know, they're all Man City fans. You know, so I like that side of it. You know, I like that working class side of it, if you can call it that. Yeah, and that's what the appeal was. You know, I just wanted to do that. You know, I just felt that I got one more season left in me.
Yeah, and then, I mean, obviously, it was the new stadium, as you say. Yeah. There's that Barcelona game is the one that launched it. Like, what are your memories of the first kind of games at what would become the Etihad?
Just like of a lot of noise. Which was great, and then just trying to get used to like a new back four, you know, that didn't talk to each other as much as what I'd been used to at Arsenal, you know, because you know I had got like two French guys, I think, and then I got like a Chinese guy as a right back, and it just was strange, you know, like, and having to shout you know, like man on, and they didn't get it straight away. You know, so there was always, you know, that communication problem. But yeah, the first few games were great. You know, and it went okay. I felt, you know, like as an overall, it was all right. You know, but it was just. The biggest thing I noticed was that, like, from being at Arsenal for 13 years and having had 7 years under Arsene Wenger, when I left and went to Man City, I realised how far ahead Arsenal were, you know, in preparation of stuff. You know, because I remember, like, my first home game, I said to Kevin, you know, I was like, oh, what time are we meeting for the match? You know, on a Saturday, say it was 3 o'clock. He'd be like, oh, 1:30. I'm like, what? You know, because I was used to meeting, you know, being like meeting up at like 10:30 in the morning, having a stretching routine, having a massive pre-match meal, and then, you know, being ready for the game. And I was like, really? I said to Kevin, I said, so how do you know what they've eaten? You know, and he was like, yeah, but they'll look after themselves. And I'm thinking, they're footballers.
So it was left to you guys to do it.
It was left more or less, yeah, to us guys to sort your own pre-match meal out, because if you can't go to the ground at 1:30 and eat something, because it's not going to work. You know, you need to be eating 3 hours before kickoff. You know, and that's what we used to do at Arsenal. You know, and it would be a lot of food. You know, and then as I kept like moaning about it more and more, Kevin then he tried it and it. You know what Kevin's like. You know, if it works straight away, I'll keep it. You know, if it works and then it doesn't work, then he started changing it. But we ended up having more pre-match meals at the ground, so it did work.
Yeah, you think of kind of that early Premier League debut. That Premier League debut, the 1-1 against Portsmouth, yeah. Last minute David Somme equaliser, actually.
Yeah.
Like in terms of moving into a new stadium, I know you're new at the club as well. But do you think City found it difficult in a new environment? It wasn't Main Road. It wasn't something that they were used to.
See, I wouldn't know that, because, you know, I'd only been to City as an away player. You know, so that atmosphere was always really hostile. Not hostile. It was intense. It was good. It was a good ground to play at. So then coming to the new stadium, it was a little bit like the Emirates at Arsenal. You know, it was a new stadium, big stadium. You know, so I didn't notice any difference, you know, and it was just, I knew that there was always a really good atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, so it wasn't strange, it wasn't anything that I'd really noticed, it was just there.
Mm. Like, as that season was going on, when did you start to struggle? You had a shoulder injury that season, didn't you?
Yeah, but I got the shoulder injury, like, right towards the end, you know, and you know, when I'm at that age, you know, of 39, 40, coming up to 40, you know, there's always, you're always like questioning yourself, and I was always being questioned, you know, and I've said this before, you know, like nearly all the way through my career, I've always been proving people wrong, you know, even from when I was 19, because I got released at 19 by Leeds United and went down fourth division. You know, so then I'm building up, and then you get to that stage where you're coming towards the end of your career, and you're still trying to prove people wrong because they're telling you you're not good enough. And it got to a stage where, you know, I was playing, but it wasn't, not that I wasn't enjoying it. It just didn't feel the same. You know, because I've come from an Arsenal team that was winning trophies to a team that was just, like, you know, that it was mid-table, you know, and staying in the division.
Yeah, I don't think it's disrespectful of that City team to say, like, it was just kind of existing for a while. Yeah. It didn't really know what it was.
Exactly, and that's a little bit like what it was when I was at QPR, you know, where we were happy to stay in the division or, you know, try and finish top half, you know, but, you know, I wanted to see how good I was when I was at QPR. That's why I went to Arsenal. I also had a chance of going to Man United. That's, you know, that
good,
was,
good choice.
I know, exactly. So, you know, so then I do all my 13 years at Arsenal, and then I'm back at a club where it's, you know, it's a new challenge for me, you know, and I still want to prove to people that I can do it. But then, you work out pretty quickly where you're going to be in the league. You know, and, you know, although we were in Europe, and was it TNS
yeah.
Something that, which I was like, Europe, well, anyway, you know, this ain't the Europe that I was used to, but but it was still, you know, it was still really enjoyable, but it was like, where are we going to finish? Do you know what I mean? You know, so then these thoughts start coming in, and I only had it once, and we were playing away at Wolves, and the ball was down the other end, and I got my arms behind my back because I normally do, and I was like, "What am I doing here? I'm not enjoying this." But that was the only time I'd ever had that feeling.
Yeah. Did you at that point did you know on the pitch at Molineux that day that you were gonna call it a day?
Yeah. So what I did was weirdly, Kevin Keegan, the manager, lived in Hale, and he'd got two ground floor apartments in this apartment block, and I rented the one next door to him, you know, so we were in constant contact. So we played at Wolves. The next day, I knocked on his door. I said, "I just want to have a chat." And I just said to him, "So look, just to let you know, I'm going to retire in the summer, you know, at the end of the season." And he was like, "Oh, brilliant." He said, "Thanks for letting me know, because then I can make plans to get somebody else in." And then literally 10 days later, we played away at Portsmouth, and I got smacked on my shoulder, and I came off in the game. And then I saw the x-rays and the scans, and there was damage. I'd sprained my AC joint as well, which meant that it could, in the future, if I came back, it could start dislocating. And I'd had that thought already, and I was like, okay, it's time for me to call it a day.
Yeah,
and that's how quick it came.
Is that as a goalkeeper thing, is that you know, you've taken a battering throughout your career, you're already diving at strikers' feet, you're throwing your body around in front of the ball.
Yeah.
Is that a point at which you've gone, actually, you know what, my body's ready for this now?
Yeah, it is, and I've spoken to people since I've retired that are coming up to, you know, that were coming up to retirement, and people have told me before, you will get a sign.
You'll know.
You know, I think Gary Neville said he spoke about when somebody went past him and he knew he couldn't get anywhere near him. Whereas, you know, when he was in his prime, he would have gotten. You know, and even like Ben Foster, I said to Ben, I says, "You'll know." And he went, yeah, he says, I went for a save. And he says, "I couldn't get up." You know, that it becomes obvious. You know, and that's what it was like for me. It was something that was, it wasn't hard for me to do, because I was 40 at the time when I retired. And I really enjoyed my career, but I was also looking forward to the rest of my life, you know, whether that be in football or, you know, I just wanted to have a bit of time or a bit of me time.
Yeah. When you think of kind of your period at City, it's very much kind of like the footnote of a great career.
Yeah.
But like, is it something you can look back on fondly? I mean, it's weird to say, because there's a lot of ex-City players who joined the club at around about that time that developed a real affinity for City. And at the same time, like, it's totally understandable that your affinity is with Arsenal.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like you've had this like nice little ending of your career at City.
Honestly, it wasn't just nice. It was a great ending to my career, because I loved it. The people of Manchester and the people at the ground and at the training ground were brilliant. You know, they were great. But, you know, they're all Northerners. You know, so we know what it's like. You know, we like each other, and, you know, we all get on, we all chat. And that's what the club was like back then. You know, and it was like a great place to be, and it was a great place for me to finish my career. You know, and it was just something that I totally enjoyed it. Mm.
When you think of, I also want to kind of ask about that era of City and kind of what the club was like, because they've moved to the new stadium. They've had a really good finish in the Premier League the season before, compared to like as a newly promoted side. Mm. Is it a shock? Is it a culture shock as someone who's come in from, you know, you've had a really settled back four in front of you at Arsenal, so, you know, a back four where you knew each other inside out? Was that part of the difficulty? If you'd had another year at Arsenal as the first choice, would you have found it a lot easier? Do you think?
I think so, because, you know, like, you take a lot for granted, you know, when you've worked with the people for so long, and then all of a sudden that just goes. I've just had a flash in my head now about when Man City played Arsenal, and I was in the tunnel. I've got to tell you this story. I was in the tunnel. Obviously, I'm now in my Man City kit, and Patrick's led out the Arsenal team with Jens Lehmann and all the lads of that. And all I can think about as I'm in the tunnel is, don't throw it to an Arsenal player. Don't throw it to an Arsenal player. that was a thought I was having in my head, you know, because I just didn't want to mess up, you know. But trying to get used to a new back four, like, which, you know, and they've got to get used to me as well. Mm. But for me, it was hard, you know, because, like I said earlier about the language as well, you know, the different nationalities that were playing in front of me, you know, so it wasn't easy. It was a wake-up call for me because it's like, oh, there's something, you've got to do something else here. You know, you've got to like either like shout a little bit earlier or, you know, like hopefully they learn English quick.
And I guess as well, you're under more pressure at City than you'd ever been at Arsenal. Because I don't imagine Arsenal were facing the pressure that City were facing at that time.
Yeah, I was having a lot more to do. Yeah, you know, there's no doubt about that. You know, like with Arsenal, it's different. You know, it's like sometimes you have nothing to do and then you've got to produce and you've got to be at your best for like one time in the game. Whereas with City, it was a lot more to do. Not a great deal of like shot stopping, but like what I call like the sweeping up work. You know,
and
like,
you've got to be switched on.
You've got to be switched on all the time and, you know, you're always involved in action, you know, but it's what it is, you know, you get used to that, you get back used to that, and it was different.
Finally, I've got to ask you, it's around about that time as well, you started doing They Think It's All Over.
Yes.
What was the reaction when the dressing room found out you were doing that?
They didn't really say a great deal, you know, and it was something that, obviously, I wanted to, like, to go that way after my, you know, so you start, you know, planting a few seeds, and... it was okay because they weren't really taking the piss out of like my Manchester teammates, you know, and it was a lot of it was more towards the Beckhams, and I had a real problem with it, you know, because they used to absolutely cane the Beckhams, and I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. I went to their wedding, you know, and I was like, oh, it was really awkward, you know, and they, when you're working with Rory McGrath and.
Remember who's the other two.
Jonathan Ross.
Yeah.
Jonathan Ross. And they are so quick. You know, and it was just like so, I found it like so hard, you know, but I did it. I think, I don't know whether I did it once, a full season or two seasons, whatever it was, but it was, you know, it was just something that I wanted to like to step into on that side. And that's why I wanted to do that because I wanted to go that side rather than going straight back into the football side, you know, and football hours, because not long after I retired, I got asked to be, you know, Petr Cech asked, you know, some of his contacts asked me to be his coach, you know, but full-time, hotels, everything. I was like, no, I've just had 22 years of that, mate. I want a little bit of a breather. And then I got asked to be, Harry wanted me to go to Tottenham with him. And I was like, I'm not throwing 13 years of Arsenal down the drain just to go and be your goalie coach, Harry. I was like, anywhere else, I would seriously think about it, but not there. But yeah, I wanted to get onto that entertainment side of, you know, and that's how Dancing on Ice came around and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and from a City fan point of view, it was, there's a City player on telly. There's a City player on telly.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was, I just enjoyed it, you know, and it was nice, you know, because, you know, coming from, you know, obviously following Peter, then me, then David James was there, you know, and it was good to always, like, look back at what was going on, you know, like, especially with J-Mo coming in and taking my place and that, and obviously joining, and Nicholas Anelka was the striker. I never forget that when, you know, after I retired, after that Portsmouth game, Nicholas scored a goal, and underneath it got a T-shirt. I've got the T-shirt at home, and it said, David Seaman, we all love you. You know, and stuff like that. You never forget things like that, you know. And you know, people like Steve McManaman, Robbie Fowler, and like loads of different players at the club. And it was just just as short as it was, it was still brilliant.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. But don't worry, it'll be over soon.
That was the former City goalkeeper, David Seaman. We're going to finish with listener questions now. And thank you to everyone who got in touch about the song for Higgy's jingle last week. A few people got in touch with the right answer. It was Nut Rocker by B. Bumble and the Stingers. I hadn't heard of it either, but go and find it on YouTube. It is exactly the same tune. But it also means that I get to play this again.
The listener's questions, the listener's questions, the listener's questions, the listener's questions. So it's the listeners' questions bit. Please make sure that yours ain't shit, cause Mooney won't put up with it. Yes, it's the listeners' questions. The listeners' questions. The listeners' questions. Thank you.
No, thank you, Higgy. That's that is the pleasure. Get in touch on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast. You can email through the website, bluemoonpodcast.com. I have updated the website to try and make it function a bit better. And in the process of doing that, I did break it. But I can confirm that the contact form is now working again. So should you want to get in touch, you can go there, bluemoonpodcast.com, and fill in the form. That's how Alan's been in touch to say, so it looks like Cheeky Biggerestein will be leaving at the end of the season. We obviously had the banner for Pep at the game on Saturday that said we wanted him to stay. And while I can't speak for all fans, I'd be surprised if anyone wants him to leave. But do you worry that this is now the changing of the guard? If Cheeky goes at the end of the season, Pep may see this as his time to go now too. Are you nervous about what comes next? Paul, I'll start with you on this, because obviously we've had Guardiola for the best part of a decade now, and it's kind of it does feel like if he were to leave at the same time as the director of football leaves, that it's going to be a very, very different thing for City next season.
Yes, obviously it has worked. The partnership's worked. There's been very few duds in terms of who we bought. I think, you know, some stick out, but the actual player selection we've had, I think, has been excellent over the last 4 or 5 years in particular. So yeah, I think he will be a huge miss if that's the case. Yeah. But what I'd say about City is, in terms of the board composition and membership, is that they do seem to be very good at succession planning, or feel like they would be. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but there must be something lined up there, or something be communicated in it shortly.
Yeah, well, the story is that whoever the new director of football is will be in place before the end of this season to kind of smooth the handover. Would that make you feel better if it was all announced like that?
It would, but I think also there's that partnership of, you know, a lot of the reason Cheeky was brought in was because they had Peppers, you know, in mind, and that was part of the partnership, and you know they wouldn't really overrule each other. They'd work together. They'd like the same profile of player.
Yeah.
Whereas whoever is next has to be sort of, needs to have in mind what Guardiola's plans are and who the successor to Guardiola might be as well.
Yeah. Do you think, Adam, we need an answer from Guardiola pretty soonish then in that case as well? Because if they do need a new director of football, then he's going to need to know if he's working with Pep or not.
Yeah, I think it helps everyone. It helps the speculation. It lets the fans know where you're up to. It lets any potential new suitors for those higher up roles, so what they're coming into. Players must be concerned with. You don't know how much is already confirmed behind the scenes. It might all be taken care of, but it doesn't help the speculation. It doesn't help with the 115 charges thing, because the conspiracy theorists get to have a day out on that one as well. But I'm concerned. I'm at peace with the fact that he's going. I don't think he'll sign a new contract. I think to this season will be a natural end for both Cheeky and Pep. And I worry about a little bit of a drop-off after that happens. I don't think it's going to be a United-style drop-off after Fergie went, or Arsenal's kind of years in the wilderness after Wenger went.
No, but let me say, like, I'm almost... I'm 99.9% sure to say as a fact that there will be a drop-off, because ultimately Guardiola is the best in the business.
Exactly.
Nobody can be as good as him.
But it's how far is that drop-off? I think it's going to be further than we think, because we're accustomed to such greatness over such prolonged period of time, that I'm just thinking we grew up, certainly our era, of just seeing City score a goal at home was enough to have a night out on the town on. So now if we're drawing 0-0 at home to Inter Milan, it's panic stations. So I just think we're going to need a bit of a reality check. We're right to have these lofted ambitions, because Pep's been so good for so long, like I say. So I do fear the drop-off, and I fear certainly the younger fans' mentality, who've never known anything but these Guardiola successes. So I think we're going to go into a cycle of a new manager every 2 years, maybe a year of rebuilding, a year of challenging, and that's absolutely fine. That's normal. It's these extraordinary feats that Guardiola's achieved that make that sound like a boring season, but actually we might just fall down a little bit. Paul's right with the hierarchy, and the structure at the club now should support a smoother transition for anyone that comes in. So it won't. I don't think we're going to go back to the doldrums of Division 2 unless someone votes us to be there. But yeah, I am concerned. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't concerned, but I am also at peace with the fact that it's happening as well.
Yeah. Are you apprehensive of the future, Paul? Scared of it? What it might look like? You know, it'll never be the same again.
Well, it's difficult to get better, and I think you know I have appreciated it. It's not over yet, but I have appreciated it. But it's hard to. It's quite relative, isn't it? And obviously, United probably, you know, appreciate Fergie, but they only appreciate more when they're gone. So I think we've just got to be. So I'm not, because, you know, you can't invent another Guardiola, and, you know, things might, you know, we might have to accept things aren't going to be quite as comfortable as they have been, but that's the reality, and they're probably not for anyone else, because Pep, fingers crossed, isn't going to go to a competitor. I can't see that happening.
imagine he rocks up at Anfield.
Yeah, God. I think it's just, we just really need to appreciate this season in particular, but I do think this is a bit of a, in a weird way, a bit of a transitional year. But, you know, the year when Fergie left, that team was a bit similar. You know, where you could see like a little bit of weakening going on, and the squad hadn't necessarily been invested in. You're like, you know, is it on that same trajectory?
Yeah. Is it unfortunate?
Is David Moyes free?
No, he'll probably be back at West Ham by the end of the season. Won't he? Is it unfortunate, Paul, that all of this, if this is to be the final hurrah for Guardiola and Cheeky in the same season, that it is to be the, like, while the charges is being sorted out, and, you know, we don't know when we'll get the verdict on that. The rumor is January, but it could well be later. It kind of, as Adam says, it kind of fuels speculation that you maybe don't want to have.
Yeah, no, I think. The timing of what's announced, if anything, is probably going to depend on that as well, and maybe even the decisions.
God, you've got me dreaming now of a not guilty verdict followed by the very next day a Guardiola extension. Can you imagine that?
Stop it.
I wonder if he's more likely to stay if we did go down, though.
Yeah, I think he would.
Out of principle.
Yeah,
yeah.
But also, it's like when Klopp left, he said, you know, as much as you want to stay on, you want someone to enjoy the life and be motivated. And if he's not motivated enough to do it, then he's not the right person at that time. And then, you know, I've seen, you know, in many sports, if people hang on a little bit too long, sometimes it doesn't end well. Whereas if it ended this season, it'd be fine. You know, he's certainly our best manager ever, and probably the best manager of all time.
Yeah, I part of me wondered if you were still talking about my goalkeeper when you said there, people hanging up too long, but we'll part that one for another time.
I need you to play. No one else wants to go in goal,
do they? No, that's what I'm clinging on to. The phone will stop ringing someday. That's it for the end of this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guest for this one, Adam Carter.
I'm off to cry now. Cheers.
Sorry about that. And Paul Atherton.
Cheers, Moons. Cheers, Adam.
There is a clip of this week's nostalgia show coming up. It's Gazzy's Games That Made Me episode, and it gets quite emotional, so prepare for that. Go and give it a listen in this international break on patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. If you fancy some Blue Moon Podcast exclusive mugs, hoodies or t-shirts, including a whole host of Wembley 99 designs, then you can now head over to shop.bluemoonpodcast.com as well and take a look. I'm not getting any more comfortable about advertising the merch store, so please go and do it and make me feel better about this bit at the end of the show. I'll be back next week to preview the games with Wolves and Sparta Prague, so I'll see you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can, and don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
This is the first ever game that I took my son to. It's funny, really, actually, because like, he was really young when I took him to that one. I didn't plan to take him quite so young, but the opportunity just came up to take him. And then COVID happened, so we didn't go to another game then for about another 18 months. For any point I was ever sort of getting a bit, you know, jaded or whatever, like just being able to experience everything again through him is just lovely, really. It's nice to sort of give someone like a... your inheritance, inheritance, while you're still there. Do you know what I mean? I know it sounds really sort of grandiose. So, you know, before every game, you know, everyone sings Blue Moon, puts a scarf up, he does it. And it's just amazing, you know, he's just part of it. My favourite bit when I go with him is literally kickoff when you're sing. Because he's just part of a lineage. You know, that club's, what, 140-odd years old, depending on what date you go from. It's just generations and generations of Mancunians that have gone and done the same thing. including me, including him, and possibly, you know, people after him as well. And he's just sort of put out that.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.